Hello and welcome all to today's webinar, Turning Redundancy into Opportunity, the Need for New Pathways. Before we get started, just a couple of housekeeping items. The slides and recording from today's session will be shared with you within the next 48 hours. So please don't worry if you miss anything or you're trying to write notes as we go. Second of all, we want this very much to be a two-way dialogue. So please, as we go along, enter any questions that you have into the Q&A section on your control bar, and we'll have some time at the end to cover them, as many of them as possible. I'm also going to apologize. I am currently, as most of the UK, still in working from home with four children off for a school holiday. So there may be a bit of background noise. So I do apologize for that in advance if that happens. So let's get started. At the moment, each time we open the news, there seems to be another tranche of companies who are making sizable reductions to their workforce or a foreboding message about what is to come. For example, yesterday's Financial Times headlines led with UK jobs set for bloodbath. And we have the OECD forecasting that 80 million people in just the OECD countries alone are going to be made redundant by the end of the year. So we need to look at new approaches to see how companies can turn redundancies into opportunity. To take you through today is myself, Chris Locke. I'm a partner and CEO for Startup Bootcamp Aspire, and I'm joined by my colleague, Lars Busch, who is the partner and CEO for Mina, but also ex-head of Nokia's Bridge Program in Copenhagen for today's session. Before we jump into today's content, just a bit of background behind Startup Bootcamp Aspire. We work with companies to offer a pioneering alternative to traditional outplacement support. Our model is based on providing exiting employees that want to start their own business with the skill set, mindset, and expert support to help increase their chance of success, whilst creating new value and positive impact for the company they are leaving. That's not normally seen through standard outplacement. It's a virtual program that provides global scalability, delivered by experienced entrepreneurs, without access to a network of experienced mentors, coaches, and investors who've helped hundreds of small businesses and startups succeed. And the Startup Bootcamp Aspire is based on a proven model that was designed to help increase the survival rate of early stage startups when we launched Startup Bootcamp back in 2010. At that point, 90% of startups failed to make it into their second year. And in the 10 years that we've run the Startup Bootcamp programs, we've helped accelerate over 870 plus startups who have a 74% survival rate of entering the second year once they've graduated, and have created over 4,000 new jobs. Over this time, we've also used this approach to support some of the largest companies like ENGIE, HSBC, IKEA, and National Grid to help co-develop new ventures designed to help deliver new business models, help them take into new markets or new customer segments to drive future growth. So what are we going to cover in today's session? Well, we've broken it into three parts. First of all, we just want to revisit what is the impact of redundancies, and then looking at what the case is for a new approach, where Lars will walk us through the work that he did with Nokia and the Bridge program. And then really distilling that into how does an organization facing these choices now look at building a new approach to redundancy that can turn it into opportunity. And I say in the final part is to be able to offer at least 10 to 15 minutes for Q&As at the end. Okay, so what is the impact of redundancies? Well, since the 1970s, redundancies become increasingly standard practice. It's a blunt but effective tool to help companies rapidly reduce cash flow, especially in times of economic volatility. But the reality is redundancies are in main bad for business. Although it's an effective short-term tool, the true cost of redundancy is far greater and more damaging to a business, especially when redundancies are seen as unfair or perceived to be unfair. And let's face it, the majority of redundancies will always be perceived at some point to be unfair. What it does is it acts as a catalyst for potential major disengagement from employees, not for those who are leaving, but for those who stay. Research has shown that post layoffs, those who survive experience a 41% decrease in job satisfaction, with over a third of them being less committed to the organization than pre-layoffs. And the impact of this disengagement isn't just a lower NPS score from the latest employee engagement survey. It has a critical effect on the bottom line. From studies that have tracked companies' profitability after major redundancies, it shows that a company on average takes over 3 years to recover its profitability back to pre-redundancy levels. And then finally, there's a lasting impact on the brand. This is amplified even further in today's world, where we have the Glassdoor effect, where negative reviews can make it harder to attract new talent. Not to mention any bad publicity or PR can actually impact existing customer brand loyalty. And so we touched on the damage to profitability on the slide before, but actually it can be a lot worse. There's significant studies that have shown that companies who make redundancy are twice as likely to end up bankrupt. But there are a number of, and even if it's not bankrupt, but significantly reduce the size of their organization. And there are a number of key drivers behind this. A recent study at the University of Canterbury showed that for every 1% of downsizing, companies experience a 31% increase in voluntary turnover within a year. That's seen a large talent drain of skills and knowledge out of the organization, which takes a significant time and cost to replace. And as redundancies are implemented, it tends to be part of a wider cost-cutting initiative. So as companies lose experience and knowledge, they also see a 24% decrease in development of new products and services, meaning that they're going to be playing catch-up when the market returns. A good example of this is what happened between Samsung and Galaxy back in 2008 during the Great Financial Crash. What we saw was Samsung, who didn't make redundancies but continued to invest into launching their Galaxy phone range, coupled with Motorola, who made sweeping redundancies and cut all R&D spend. The impact of those two decisions were played out over the next couple of years, as Motorola saw 45% of its revenue disappear and saw its market share erode by 9.5% between 2008 and 2010. While Samsung, on the other hand, increased its market share by 61.1%, but more importantly, also grew its revenues by 28%. So it has a sizable impact around being able to be prepared for when an organization, when the market returns after economic volatility. And then finally, for those who stay, there's extensive studies now that demonstrate there's a clear decrease in productivity from those who survive. That, when an organization is already squeezed on cash flow, can have a significant impact onto the P&L and meeting key targets. But it's not just the business impact of redundancy, there's a human cost to that as well. From those who were made redundant, 74% showed there was a drop in productivity in their own service as soon as they were laid off. And once they enter the job market, just under half, even when they return to work, return to jobs that are either a lower pay or aren't able to return to the workforce at all. And then when employers are major employers within local communities, what we see is once organizations make these types of redundancies, it has a knock-on effect to the local communities. And research shows there's a 13% contraction of the local economy when large companies make redundancies into where there are major players. So this data is all taken from sort of the last 15 to 20 years on the impact of redundancies to organizations. However, what we're now facing is something a lot different. We're facing this perfect economic storm. And I always like to think of it as a maths equation. We have a number of variables coming together. We've got mass redundancies, not just across one sector, but multiple sectors, the speed and scale of which I haven't seen before in my lifetime. We're seeing the end of furloughing schemes, which in many respects have helped, but also have delayed the inevitable of seeing another wave of people exiting jobs and hitting the job market. And then we have a stagnant job market. So I believe between February and April, in Europe alone, saw a 30% sort of decrease in job vacancies, which equates to around 2 million roles. And that is continuing to happen as we go through, not just in the European level, but at a global level. When you pull all these things together, we're about to hit probably the deepest economic recession in living memory, as many forecasters now admit that the V-shaped recovery is highly unlikely to happen, and our path back to growth to be exceptionally slow. And just in terms of to understand the scale of this impact, when we talk about it not being seen before, this was a quote from yesterday from Brad Smith, who's president of Microsoft, Over a quarter of a billion people are set to lose their job by the end of this year. So as organisations, with ourselves help being in the driving seat of and making these decisions and having to make these cuts, you know, the solutions that we now keep providing around traditional outplacement are not fit for purpose. We know that from the interviews that we've had and the conversations that we've had of HR, the quote we've got here is very similar that we hear time and time again, that outplacement rarely demonstrates any ROI or tangible value for money, yet we do it because it helps us feel good about ourselves and our leaders sleep easier at night. Over the years, we've spent a fortune but haven't seen any tangible outcomes or impact. And we've seen that in that redundancies can impact, the impact redundancies can have on our people, our profits and our local community. So we think it's that we need a new approach for a new normal. We can't do what we've always done before and expect that to be okay. So what we want to look at now is how can a new approach could work. So what I'm going to do at this point is welcome Lars to the conversation, because I think it's the example that Nokia had is kind of, it was relevant then, but I think it's even more relevant now. Lars, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Chris, and thanks for inviting.
No problems. So it'd be great to dig a bit deeper behind sort of the Nokia experience. So can you tell me kind of what your role was, and then before that, kind of before Nokia set up the bridge, where was it kind of in terms of business performance and economically?
Yeah, so without going all the way back to the birth of Nokia and the entire making, then the early 2000s was Nokia was on fire as the mobile brand number one. 2009 reached a overall fifth place on top value brands in the world. And then you can say then it was a quite deep dive when we only a few years later kind of hit the wall and started firing people. Of course, there's been a lot of speculation and a lot of conclusions on what happened to Nokia. I saw an interesting headline saying internal politics. That was the, as some would call that, poor management. But there, of course, it was a mix of internal and external factors. We were under tremendous pressure from Apple and Samsung. In my humble opinion, coming from the engineering side of things, back in those days, we really were not, Nokia was not beaten by a better mobile phone out there, but from the App Store. Like a really misunderstanding of the user pattern of the users. We have spent so many years on optimizing the engineering side of things rather than the user experience and the complete change to apps. So that is of course a much longer story. But what happened, and also relevant for this discussion today, is that Nokia saw a couple of hard years before the real dive. So for my own role, I was head of mechanics when it started going bad, which means the guys that design all the stuff that that you can see and feel. And back in 2009 and 10, we started shaving off 20% of the staff per year, and was still expected and even able to deliver, you could say, on the same level. The first year was easy. That was cutting fat. The second year was not so fun. And we all thought, we cannot do another year. But then the third year, it was super easy because that was firing everybody. And rather than being, as you mentioned, the colleagues' relationships really falling apart, the first 2 years, then suddenly we were all in the same boat again as one big family and closing down the whole ship. So I was sitting in Copenhagen at the time. And going into that closure, I headed smartphones R&D in the end, but that was more with the focus to close in a nice way. And then I was heading the bridge incubator where we granted new startups across the globe from ex-employees that wanted to start their own business.
And just before we go into the incubator, I mean, what was the Bridge program anyway, and why was it created? So just from a more macro level before we dive into the incubator side of it.
Nokia being a Scandinavian Finnish company, there was always a tremendous focus on the one company value that was called very human. And to this day, I still think that was the route that actually promoted Bridge. Bridge was, I think, in the early days, put in place to both part security, support people, and so on. But it was also a tool to make people work hard until the last day. Our challenge is that in Copenhagen, we jumped up on a stage in front of almost 1,500 people and said, yeah, you're all fired, but we expect you to work your ass off the next 12, 18 months because we have made promises on your behalf. So that was a very challenging situation, and we needed something to look forward to other than just a severance package. And the Bridge program became this machine where you look forward as an employee to finish your job and then come to Bridge and start to make some new choices for the rest of your life.
And what were the various parts? And you talked about the Bridge incubator, and was that always an element, a pathway open from the start, or was it created later on?
From early days, the management in Copenhagen, we basically got a Bridge information package. So of course, this has been in the making for a while, generated out of Finland. But from day one, the Bridge program as such was five paths you could choose when being redundant or being laid off from Nokia. Those five paths was maybe the least used one was something called create your own path. I think that's more like just to create a choice. I never really found out what that was about. Then we had learned something new, which in reality meant that a couple of the real hardcore geeks chose to go into a PhD situation or back to school somehow, and was supported from Nokia on that. And then one path was find a new job within Nokia. That was like, back in those days, it meant move to China, and then we have a chance to find you a job. And then the remaining two paths was basically, obviously, find a new job outside Nokia, which meant outplacement support, a lot of workshops around how to do that, and a lot of networking effort to do that. And then we had start a new business. And start a new business became this this incubator. And early on, we did not think that it would have this success. Or that many people would go in that direction. Have in mind that in a site like Copenhagen, we were around 1,500 people, all like half engineers, and with an average seniority of 10 years. Right? It was not people straight out of school. It was hardened engineers that suddenly jumped back to entrepreneurial mode.
Okay, what did the start your own pathway look like? So what was the Bridge incubator? What did it consist of? How did it work? And then how were you able to join? Did you have to have an idea coming into it? Or it'd be great to find a bit more about how it played out.
Yeah, so from the employee's point of view, it was kind of a sliding process because you very shortly after the big message that, okay, we are closing down Copenhagen and a few other sites and laying off a couple of tens of thousands of people. Then you got an ending date and you got an ending date for your work when you were expected to work. And you got a date for when we are going to fire all of you. So that was a given. So every month more people came out of this, of the old employment and moved into the Bridge program, so to say. For the incubator, in the beginning, there was a lot of focus, of course, on money. You had your severance package, and with long seniority, there was a lot of people that walked away with a year's salary in the back pocket and had a nice engineering job somewhere else the next day. From the incubator point of view, we gave out grants The grants was from 10 to 25,000 euros per person and up to four persons in one team. Which means that if you found three Nokia colleagues and had an idea to build a tech company somehow, then you could walk away with another 100,000 euros completely free, no obligations attached, and try to build your company with that. But the money itself became less and less important, I would say. So the incubator was also a physical space. We basically took over a whole floor in a main building and started to create a more entrepreneurial environment. Nokia became the first corporate sponsor for Startup Bootcamp. We asked simply Startup Bootcamp to move in the same premises and thereby hooked into a bit of the Startup Bootcamp vibe, the investors, the mentors. And then we hired part-time ex-VCs to help people build business plan, introduce business canvas modeling. I mean, this was all very new for all the Nokia people that have been doing the same thing for 10, 15 years.
And how would that all, because it's always one of the questions that we get asked around, you know, can that entrepreneurial kind of mindset be taught and equipped with the skills? But it sounds like kind of from the pathway you were able to, you know, you were able to equip them with the right skill sets.
We can always discuss how much can be taught. I think that a lot of Nokia engineers re-experienced their inner entrepreneur, inspired by suddenly having choices. And many of them had a small idea somewhere underneath that was waiting to get out. And this was suddenly the spark they had been waiting for. It was inspiring to have also like engineers that you didn't really notice this and that guy in the normal daily life producing phones in volume. But then suddenly you see these guys come to the office every morning completely with the shiny eyes and they're completely focused on creating their own company. So I think a lot of people had a revival or came back to the roots. But also, of course, a lot of people that had never been anything else than corporates tried it out and failed. And also a bunch of them tried it out and succeeded. So I think you have all categories.
And then just in terms of kind of one of the things that we, you know, it is one of the questions that people have is not many people want to go and, if you look at sort of people being made redundant, and not many people want to go and kind of go off and start their own business. I mean, can you sort of think around sort of the number of people that you actually had go through, not just the bridge program in Copenhagen, but the bridge incubator globally, sort of percentage wise, do you know what the numbers were?
So I see numbers that the number of startups coming out of the start your own business track of bridge is around 1,000 companies. I was responsible for the grant due diligence and payout globally outside Finland. And in the 18 months I was heading that, I handed out grants to around 300 companies, 65 companies in Copenhagen.
And were they all tech first companies, or did you have a range of different businesses being started? I mean, sorry, the question is, did Nokia insist that it had to be a tech-related business, or was it open to anything that the employer wanted to explore, or the employee wanted to explore?
We really tried not to judge that something is better than something else. First of all, it was about letting people build something they were happy about and create a new future for themselves. But we had this into the process that as I said, the grants was 10 to 25,000, depending on the kind of scale of potential impact. And the more you wanted to build a real tech company, the higher grant you could get. But roughly, I would put it in three categories. all these solutions that became startups. So you had this that you would assume this is a real ex-Nokia startup, like hardcore techie, engineering heavy. Nokia even also offered people that was terminated to take patents from the Nokia patent bank and use the patent completely free of charge for a lifetime without any royalties or anything like that. So those companies that was tech heavy was around a third or so, maybe a little bit more. And then we had the, you could argue the same thing, but single people that did a consultancy company, or somehow you don't try to build a venture company, but you build a revenue based one or two guy shop and you work as a freelancer or whatever. That was a little bit less than a third. And then there was this last third that was completely random ideas. I do remember we had this pitching 2 days per week where people came and presented their ideas. And when we started the rating of which kind of grant could Nokia give. And I remember that I was surprised quite a few times. Like I think the we had, for instance, the absolute best antenna developer team in Copenhagen. And one guy had always dreamt about making a plantation for Christmas trees. So that was his new future. And another guy was starting a completely sustainable green kite surfing production. So there was really some odd ideas in between there. But that's roughly the split between the three.
And then in terms of for Nokia itself, I mean, what the impact did Nokia see from offering the bridge program?
I think the bridge program as a whole have received like a lot of positive feedback. The incubator as such, if anybody is investing in startups or interested in startups and have visited Finland or just go to Slush or something like that, and then see how many of these startups are actually anchored in founders that jumped out of Nokia or startups that was established around that time, 2011 to 13. It had a tremendous positive impact on the entire ecosystem. But there was a lot of, I mean, the whole process, find a new job outside Nokia, was another very, very important track that was where a lot of interesting new processes was invented. People help each other to find new jobs. And wherever we close down big Nokia sites, of course, the local ecosystem had a tremendous boost from a lot of these clever engineers. On the startup side, I mean, in my world, I work with startups every day. things changed. The world changed in those couple of years. A lot of strong startups came.
Yeah, and I was doing a looking at the alumni, and a large majority of them are kind of still funding and still kind of rapidly growing. And then what's interesting, I read kind of another review on it, which was said actually one of the interesting things was out of the ideas that came out of it, Nokia actually entered into commercial agreements with a number of the ideas that launched through the incubator to actually help kind of accelerate some of their own innovation. I mean, I don't know if you had any experience of startups kind of who came through the Copenhagen program being reintegrated into or being working kind of then going into partnership with Nokia afterwards.
It was a chaotic time. Nokia was really hitting rock bottom while being groomed for sale to Microsoft. So a lot of stuff was tried out, and I think that it was both a, of course, an innovative commercial side of things, but there was also a lot of support to simply help people just get one step further with their startup. So Nokia did, the people in Nokia and Nokia as a whole really made a tremendous positive impact and are still remembered for that. I mean, when I see the Nokia alumni now, very soon, 10 years after, still gathering once per year, still helping each other get new jobs, still building startups together. That's very inspiring.
That is exceptionally inspiring. Actually, I was, again, on speaking to somebody else who was also involved, and they were saying one of the interesting things they saw was during that time for the sites that had been, for all the sites that had been infected, that had been impacted, the offer of the Bridge program, in particular the Bridge Incubator, it allowed them to, they still hit sort of forecasted revenue targets. I think they had a sort of 3.4 billion euro target. And whilst many were expecting that to be missed during the transition, actually it kind of hit, they hit quarter after quarter. And a lot of that was put down to the impact that the Bridge program had in terms of keeping employees engaged. And to your point, you said earlier, you know, giving them a sense of purpose beyond kind of once Nokia, kind of their journey with Nokia as a full-time employee had ended. So just out of interest, for those who are thinking around offering this type of pathway, I mean, what advice would you give organizations if they were considering to put something together of a Bridge Incubator? From your reflections, what are the key factors of success?
Yeah, good point. I mean, what really helped us succeed was to set down a diverse team focused on making these redundancies a success, rather than see it as a bad thing happening. I remember the first week we worked on this, we kept getting these depressing statements and ways to communicate kind of on a corporate level, but somebody smart said, okay, from now on, we are going to call this 1,000 Bright New Futures instead. That's the headline here. Let's try to be positive about this and then create something out of this miserable situation. But the other thing, which I think is very important, also when we discuss with companies that are making redundancies now, is to focus less on the money part of things. And I don't mean just give them away. No, the other way around. What people really, really need in the situation when you lay off hundreds or thousands is not 1 or 2 months more or less on the final salary. It's a kind of a positive, again, a positive communication. It's a hand stretch out to help. It's maybe the exact right mentor or sparring partner in that moment, where they have a opportunity to kind of start a new era or start a new phase of their life. So I think the help to pick people up, the space for people to talk to like-minded and people in the same situation, but then as soon as possible, push people out of this huge challenge and start to build something, start to do something positive. Of course, we modified our approach to the fact that a majority of our population was engineers and engineers like facts and engineers like a process to develop a process and so on. And we built that in so it felt like a comfortable way forward. So I think, that's the two main ones. Dedicated people that try to create a success for the people laid off. And then, and it doesn't have to be HR, right? It can also be a couple of senior directors that are just, that just care about that and want to invest their passion in that. And then, think much more about a supporting structure and a network and a way forward, much more than how much money can we now squeeze out and give to people? Because that is secondary.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I think HBR covered it, or Harvard Business Review covered the Nokia approach. And I think that they talked about it being a 4% investment into creating the bridge as part of the total redundancy budget, and it delivered. And that's what they by their measurement was kind of a 15 times return on investment. But also, I think to your point, though, Lars, actually what it did do was it kind of kick-started ecosystems, but also really turned what was a very negative message into something exceptionally positive. And to your point, that still carries on today. I think it's remarkable that you've still got Nokia alumni meeting, sharing, supporting each other as a family.
I think when you meet 5 years after, nobody can remember what was the severance check. But everybody can remember those workshops where they learned something new and started creating something new. So I think that's worth having in mind.
Perfect. Lars, thank you so much. You're going to be around for questions at the end. So if anyone has further questions to follow up with Lars, please start putting them into the Q&A box and we'll be able to come to them in about sort of 5 to 10 minutes time. Lars, thank you very much. That was great.
Thanks.
So I think building on from that conversation, Lars, is how do we turn what we saw at the front end of today's session around sort of the negative impact that redundancy can have? How can we use this as a catalyst to turn that negative into a positive and actually help those launch? Because, you know, if you look at the current environment that we're moving into, is that we know there are not going to be, we know that, for example, latest direct line research showed that just over a third of people who have been made redundant want to use it as an opportunity to start their own business. That coupled with the fact that there is, you know, with the levels of redundancies happening, it's going to become more and more difficult to find new sources of revenue and on new jobs to locate. So how can we create that new approach together to be able to turn some of those negative stats into positive? And so based on what kind of the conversation Lars and I had prior to this and some other work that we've done and projects that we've worked on, there are a number of key factors that we can do that can increase the chance of success, but also set you up to be able to run something like this. And the first one is to facilitate collaboration. One of the things that's been really interesting to see during this time is that every single role has been impacted in terms of redundancies. We're seeing engineers, talent, we're seeing developers, we're seeing sales, marketing. And actually that exiting of such a diverse talent pool is a really great opportunity to bring together cross-functional teams to actually work on ideas. So the way that an organization can help facilitate that collaboration before they exit, to be able to what I call have those collisions with each other, to identify where there might be areas of they could potentially work together, or just create that cohort community, allows to facilitate the collaboration to build those diverse teams to go after some of those key challenges. So definitely something there to be able to facilitate. The second part is to be really clearly established the role that the company wants to play in facilitating this. You know, Lars talked about Nokia opening up the patent library and letting people take kind of unused patents to go and work on those and develop this into a commercial proposition royalty free. So there's an idea here, which is kind of, can you set out kind of organization, can you offer access to assets the company might have that are not being fully utilized or underused, or are you able to set out key challenge statements that some of your talent leaving could potentially work on and actually help you drive kind of faster innovation outside the organization than it would be if they stayed inside it. The second part is the level of funding that you want to play. Now, you know, Lars was talking about the fact that Nokia made their seed funding from 10,000 to 25,000. There are different ways that you can play in that, whether it's offering seed funding or all the way through to actually coming at the end of it, one of the startups at a certain level coming out of the program that you might be running. You know, you may want to invest once they've got some traction and take a minority stake in that business, or look at working in a commercial partnership. And then finally, it's about how do you want to track the impact that you have. So one of the things I think is super interesting, particularly as we move into a world where ESG becomes increasingly important for organizations, is to use this as a way to feedback around from offering this alternative pathway to help those departing talents start their own businesses, not necessarily tech first startups, but small businesses or launch their freelance career. What is the economic impact that has? What is the number of new jobs that's created? And that is a really great thing to sort of be able to play back. So if you're able to track that long tail, it feeds back into the ESG agenda. I think the kind of key thing is during any point, particularly when companies are executing redundancies, but also it tends to be in running in parallel with other transformation activities, it's really difficult to be able to offer something different and be able to put the full resource behind it to run it internally. And at this point, you know, it's about finding the right partner who can give you that peace of mind that if you're going to put something in place that's innovative and pioneering, that your people are going to be looked after from sort of end to end and you have peace of mind. So I think it's about, obviously you can offer kind of traditional pathways, whether that's a couple of online modules or what the existing outplacement companies offer, which may be a couple of 90-minute sessions with a coach. But genuinely, you know, in order to increase the chance of success, to be able to find that partner who brings that experience to give you the peace of mind that allows you to build something that is kind of leading and pioneering, it's a really important part of this to be able to run it successfully. And then it is about communicating, you know, both internally and externally. One of the things that is, there's one of the gaps is to be able to bridge that productivity gap to help kind of keep those who are surviving engaged. We need to be able to communicate when you're doing things pioneering something like this. There needs to be a big campaign going internally that says, even we recognize that the world has shifted, that we are adapting what we offer to meet the new world, sort of the new normal. But more importantly, we're making sure we're looking after our people. Even if that in terms of the overall population being very redundant, is still kind of a between sort of 7 to 10%, 12%. It is something new and different that says that you look after them. But also it's a great thing to be able to communicate externally. As Lars was saying, there, some of the halo effect that Nokia experienced out of offering the bridge was, you know, at the point where it could have been left certain kind of local economies on the verge of bankruptcy and hives of unemployment, it's actually been used to regenerate and create a whole new ecosystem out there. And being an orchestrator of that, it could be a really critical role and something that helps enhance one's sort of own brand capabilities. So those are kind of some sort of the key things around how to kind of create that new approach. But I think kind of we bring it all together before we move into Q&A. I suppose from our perspective, what we're seeing is, you know, we are entering a period of time which is unlike many of us have ever seen before, and hopefully we'll ever see again. And to be able to turn redundancy into opportunity, we need to help offer new pathways that can mitigate that drop in productivity, but also enhance the brand during these difficult times and actually position you to be able to, when the market returns, be in a position to be that still that beacon of to attract new talent. But also to drive faster innovation. Right? One of the benefits from that is if you have a lot of experienced talent in exiting, then you have the opportunity to get them to actually work on those challenges, which you can then bring back and help you drive your own innovation faster, particularly if you've been in that position where you've had to scale back some of your own activities because of cash flow constraints. So it becomes a real multiplier and amplifier to help drive that innovation. And then finally, it's a much more of a softer one, but I think critically important in these times. If we talk about living our people first values, it's about doing the right thing by your departing talent and the communities that you serve. To be able to pay back and recognize that, you know, it's easy to offer the straight exit of outplacements. It's never easy to offer it, but it's a simple thing to be able to do, be able to just kind of divert them into traditional paths. But we have an opportunity to do something different and be able to stand out and, let's say, put something in place which is relevant for the new world and the new economy that we're moving into. That brings us to the end of sort of the slides and the discussion. So really it's now time to turn it over to you for any Q&A. We've got some kind of questions coming. So Lars, if you're able to sort of jump back in, it'd be great to have you come into this. Do you have any names of companies that were born out of the incubator from Nokia?
Yeah, of course. We don't have Airbnb or another unicorn, but we have a couple of hundred brands out there. if you are part of the for instance the Danish ecosystem, then you know Bluetown, who are nowadays building standalone mobile base stations in Africa, completely disconnected from the grid. So everything is run by solar power. And they put one of those in a village and then everybody's connected. We have Cortrium, which is a company in Copenhagen that have been around for a while now, since back then, and had a couple of different functions. But the base idea was to create a doctor, village doctor in a box. They started out with the Cisco competition and then built from there. We have a company like Realm, which are very successful company in San Francisco. They started out building a new software language, got jumped to a Y Combinator exactly right after the Nokia closure. So quite a few companies still around.
I came across Jolla, which was using one of those ones that commercialized one of the operating systems that they were able to access inside Nokia to launch the new operating system as well. Is it Me Too or Me? The name of it escapes me, the operating system that they were able to kind of build in from Nokia. And then also something like Realm and Better Doctor as well. The other two I came across were alumni from the incubator program. Great. We've got another one. So how did you assess and measure the startup success, and how did they add value into the current Nokia corporation?
We didn't have a lot of time to do that. It takes time to build a startup. I was on an 18-month job here to deploy some support grants and to create a frame to make it happen. I hired an ex-serial entrepreneur / VC to sit next to me 3 days per week and help get the company started and much more important, help rate the ideas and give feedback and help people to adjust the initial idea to something that could actually have a market effect. The long-term measurement is not really systematically followed up. I know that the Finnish universities have done a lot to follow the startups, and I've seen some different studies out there. But personally, I kind of let go shortly after I left Nokia and started building own startups.
I mean, just to add on to that, I mean, and it's not the Nokia example, but from the work that we've done with other organizations where we've worked with internal talent to build new ventures. Once we do that, normally they are looking at setting. So they will have kind of key criteria, normally around just kind of market size, revenue opportunity, but also in terms of business model. So one of the ones that we've been working with a company called Ramble, they've been looking at how do they evolve, moving away from a consultancy model into more of a data first SaaS based business model. So the new ventures that we've been taking internal talent with to help kind of build their own startups have been all SaaS based startups, sort of SaaS based ventures that they've launched. And that's been a way they've been able to test without kind of risk to the core brand, new business models and potential looking at opening up new markets and new customer segments, particularly interesting in some of the long tail opportunities with things like architecture to be able to access them. So once you do this, and depending on the level of engagement that an organization has, these are some of the problem statements or challenges that you can set out to departing talent, say, how do we evolve our business model from a consultancy into much more of a SaaS-based one within the areas of kind of where we have digital twin, air quality, and a few other kind of focus areas that they wanted to double down on. So you can set that, and that's a really great pull then from ideation, and then the organization will have their own way of being able to assess kind of the traction of startups gets to whether they want to continue the investment into them. Any other questions? Okay, I'll give a couple of minutes, but just say that this is this will be the first of a series of webinars that we'll be doing, and we will be taking a pause for the summer break, but we'll be back in early September with the next series. In the meantime, if you'd like to contact either myself or Lars to find out more about Startup Bootcamp Aspire or the work that Lars did with Nokia, then please feel free to reach out either by email or directly contact us or connect with us on LinkedIn. And actually, before so we've got a question: how much did Nokia invest into it?
I actually don't have the total number.
I think I do. I think the overall investment for the total bridge program globally, and this is the 4%, it was around 50 million, which encapsulated everything. And that was, but again, that was part of it, and that was 4% of their overall redundancy stroke transformation budget that they invested into creating this.
When we were laying off thousands of people in legislations where it's very hard to lay off people, including Japan and other places where it's very expensive to do these cuts. So yeah, a lot of money was spent on the actual closure. But only a small part of that to the extra effort for Bridge, I think.
So a couple more. Do you have to make an investment like that, or are there other ways to fund this? What have we? Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, there is absolutely, of course, other ways. And that's obviously going through the Nokia experiences. Is obviously they were going through a major transformation. So somebody like, for example, BP, who've announced a similar type of initiative where they're exiting a core business of oil and gas and shift into net zero, and part of that's going to be a workforce reorganization, will normally have that type of budget to play with. What we normally say is this can actually be done within the constraints of any existing outplacement budget. And so there are a number of options for you to be able to engage with that, and happy to pick that off offline with you to see how that can be structured in a more cost-effective way rather than have to invest the 50 million.
And I think that it's a very relevant question. And for me, the main thing Bridge brought to the Nokia employees was choices. And building on that, what happened if, I mean, we had an easy situation that we could actually ask people to choose between an outplacement or go into the incubator, which had roughly the same cost. But if you don't plan to do that, what happens if you ask the people made redundant to actually pay something themselves? What if they should pay $2,000-$3,000? If everybody says no to that, then maybe the opportunity is not valid or communicated good enough. I would try to be creative around how to make it happen, and then let people make their own choices. But that's a key in that situation.
Yeah. And actually, we did hear of a company who does the same thing. So they offer a 75-25% matching scheme. So there is the participant has to put some of their own investment into that, albeit a much smaller percentage. But it just means that there's a buy-in to the program, and again, more likely to have sort of the vested interest in something that's provided always kind of free. So it's definitely a creative way to be able to do that. And then Lucien, from companies facing redundancies and interest in a program like this without much of an idea of where to start, what would you suggest? Lucien, I'm happy to have a conversation with you kind of after this on kind of share some thoughts on how to get started, and just to understand where you're at and the types of size and focus areas, and we're happy to share some thoughts and approaches that could work. So we'll happily reach out to you kind of after. And then a question from Roger: until what stage did the startups receive support from Nokia, and how was the continuation structured?
Really a good question. And I think it's essential. For Nokia, we had an expiration date, right? So we knew this is the date where we close down. So nothing happens after that. And that means that the first people that was made redundant, they actually could have maybe up to 18 months staying in an incubator environment, leaning on each other and kind of had more time to adapt to a new reality. Whereas the late the guys that was laid off in the end, they maybe only had 4 or 6 months. I do, however, think that it's extremely important that there was this end date. You kept people sharp. You kept people focused that there is an end to this. And why I'm mentioning this specifically, not to put anybody down or anything like that, but Ericsson tried something similar with a little twist that they thought it was such a pity to tell people that now they couldn't show up in the incubator before. So they just let people stay forever, basically. And they just didn't have this push. They simply didn't have that output. It's super important to create that frame to let people land on their feet again, get going, keep the speed, have the right coaching, a little bit of capital maybe. But then there is an endpoint where you are not the parent anymore. A startup is a startup. It's not a corporate safe job. If you really want to build a startup, you're on your own. So I think it's totally fair that that this is a limited period of time of support.
Fantastic. Thanks, Lars. I think that takes us to end of all of our questions. So if there we're almost at the top of the hour. Thank you all so much for your time and hope you enjoyed today's session. We shall be following, let's say, with the recording of today straight away and the slides that we shared within the next 48 hours. And in the meantime, please feel free to reach out and contact us on below. Have a fantastic rest of the day and look forward to speaking to you all very soon. Thank you.